Hey, Julian, listen to this. The bosses at Cambridge 105 Radio, they're giving us an extra 30 minutes.
Lucy, I've always liked them.
That means there's more time for community interviews.
And more about local entertainment and theatre.
And there's more time for requests on Jukebox Friday.
Join us for Cambridge Breakfast, weekdays on Cambridge 105 Radio, from 7 to 9.
30.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
Food rationing started in January 1940, 4 months after the start of World War II. It ran for the next 14 years and changed our eating habits for more than a generation. So, would any post-Brexit shortages improve the lot of our overweight nation? We wonder. Dr. Sue Bailey is here to answer our question. Is it a silly question?
It's not a silly question. I mean, it's an interesting thing because, obviously, rationing carried on until 1955.
Mm.
So it's certainly within, if you like, post-war generation. Well,
that's basically my mother's entire childhood, if I think about this properly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the sort of the baby boomers, it was part of their childhood. So in that sense, people, you know, those of us around now, as it were, if post-baby booms, because it's quite a sizable chunk,
yeah,
we'll remember what happened.
So what were we eating before 1940?
Well, again, it depends where you were in terms of whether there had been shortages. You know, there'd been the general strike then, before then. Things
so
hadn't been necessarily...
there were already factors.
Well, things hadn't necessarily been good in the 30s. Mm. Again, it depends which social group you were from in that sense. But people were growing still a lot more of their own produce. It was much more localised.
Mm.
We weren't importing in quite the same way. Although, interestingly, I've read some documents of the 30s. And again, there's lots of foods that were still being imported, but not in the same amount that we really expect them all now.
What kind of thing were we importing?
Well, we were doing things like oranges and lemons, which frankly won't grow very happily in the English climate, but they were certainly available. And also very rich people had hothouses, so things like pineapples and so on were grown in hothouses.
Right.
So yeah.
I think my mum famously, I don't know how old she would have been, not that old, but she put in a request for as a Christmas present of, I think it was a pineapple. I think it was a pineapple that she asked for Christmas because it was seen, I guess, as
quite exotic.
Pretty exotic in Essex.
Yes. And also, interestingly, I mean, this is going back further than the 30s, 1930s, people used to rent out their pineapples. So you
Sorry?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So if you happen to have a pineapple, it would slightly do the rounds and almost be rented out as a sort of decorative object
on
the centre of the table. No, you would take a slice.
I said there's a danger that you come back and a couple of chunks are missing.
Not quite.
So, in terms of the food rationing, that came in 1940.
Yes,
and ran for as you said through into the early 1950s.
Yes.
So when we came out of it, what then happened? Was there a rush to get in, I don't know, an extra pineapple or something else, or did the change to our diets happen slowly? I'm thinking particularly, I suppose, that we were healthy, and I'm wondering how long those, if you like, the habits of rationing stayed with us.
Well, I think things, interestingly, like sweets, that was an exciting thing for children to be able to have sugar.
Mm.
And so in that sense, possibly that generation's teeth are not as good as they should have been.
But reverse effect.
Yeah, reverse effect in that sense. But certainly it was rarely when supermarkets were beginning to start out, the corner shop was declining. So suddenly there was this sort of wealth of products in the sort of the, you know, you've never had it so good post-war times, where people thought, oh, yes, we can do this. And of course, more women were working. They were used to working, obviously, during the Second World War. And then there was a sort of move a bit back to the home and... But then women in the 60s and 70s, and certainly once things such as birth control came in, women thought, hey, we want to get out. We want to get out and do stuff. And there was much more convenience food coming in, Vesta curries and like that.
Yes.
Yeah, so these early convenience foods were around, but not in the same volume. that we really expect them all. Now, there were no ready meals other than the sort of the Vesta and the frozen things, fish fingers and so on. Yeah.
So almost really you had these two things colliding, which was the end of rationing and the arrival of the supermarket and those early convenience foods.
That's
which
right,
almost
that's
like
right.
an unperfect storm, if there was such a thing.
Yeah, exactly so. Exactly so. But and then we were beginning to expect, and this really didn't happen till probably early 80s, this expectation of non-seasonal products.
Yes.
And things such as, you know, green and red peppers were actually, strangely enough, considered to be exotic in the sort of late 70s and early 80s. I mean, we wouldn't consider them to be exotic now at all. And in fact, you know, if you've got a greenhouse, you can grow them yourself. But it's this expectation of non-seasonal products that's probably one of the most changed things, I'd say.
We'll talk about that in a moment or two. And also, in the event of any Brexit-induced food shortages, as to what kind of things might be affected. I'm assuming we're getting into the realms of fantasy, but you never know. So I couldn't resist, having heard a song by Vesta Williams, Once Bitten, Twice Shy, to take a look, could we possibly still get Vesta products if we tried? And we found a website.
Yes, you can.
Which sells them. And look at this. We've got Dr. Sue Bailey with us as well. Vesta curry and rice with beef. Vesta chow mein.
With the exploding crackers on top.
How do they explode?
Well, when you put them in hot oil, they puff up.
Oh, of course.
As a very small kid, I remember being so excited by this.
They've got more beef and vegetables apparently as well.
There.
Well, yes, that's the classic one that everybody remembers. Complete bargain. Are they actually any good for you? I said probably not, or less bad.
In one sense, they were freeze-dried, they were dehydrated. So in terms of what happened, the vitamins, they'd gone out the window in that sense. But it was sort of post... It was when food was being frozen, but people had tiny little freezer boxes on top of their fridges. Dehydration and freeze drying was the sort of foodie science thing of the moment then. And so things like instant coffee was available, dehydrated peas, and then these lovely weirdo meals. Sorry.
No. But that's fine. I'm sure the manufacturer, or were they? It's not. They don't make them at Premier Foods or something down the road or anything like that, do they?
I don't know.
Food shortages at Brexit, it's a little bit far-fetched, he said optimistically, but if, for example, the supply chain did start to close up, what might we lose from the supermarket shelves?
What do we instantly recognise as missing because of all this?
Ooh, that's quite a tricky one.
Is it?
Because I think, again, there's this whole issue of what sort of things will happen in terms of different tariffs. And at the moment, everyone's worried about sort of no-deal Brexit, what exactly is going to happen,
but
if it's going to be elongated.
You know, it used to be the case that strawberries would come in a little cardboard punnet, can I say, not necessarily a plastic one, and the nicest strawberries you would get actually round about Wimbledon fortnight conveniently.
Yes.
And you could then probably a couple of months later you'd get some kind of okay ones which would come over from Holland, and then would be the last of a strawberry you'd see for another 12 months. That's not the case anymore.
No. I mean, for example, I tasted some strawberries recently from Egypt and they actually had a good flavour. So it's not just necessarily from Europe we're importing things all year round. So depending on where the climate's best for growing those products. But again, it's those sort of things we've forgotten about, is air miles, you know, the cost of air freight. It's quite a contentious area, but I think a lot of food businesses are quite concerned, and restaurants and cafes and everybody who's involved in food, it's a very large part of the economy. So this sort of uncertainty is not doing people a lot of good.
We've got a lot of international restaurants around Cambridge, not all European, of course, but presumably some of them, European or not, will be getting foodstuffs in from Europe, which is then turned around, made into something nice, and sold to people in Cambridge.
It's one of those areas that people are very uncertain about at the moment, and I think very worried about, rightly so, in the whole food business, whether it's manufacturing or production or, you know, as you said, the restaurant cafe area.
How self-sustainable are we these days? Is it possible? You know, there are I remember my granddad always had his sort of, allotment down his garden, effectively. I don't think you have that too much. There are allotments, of course, around the city, Trumpington, for example. Yeah, and there's actually a square behind, but between me and the travel lodge, there's a batch of allotments, but that's not going to feed the whole of Cambridge, is it?
No, it's not. But having said that, allotments have become much more popular, and the idea of sort of food boxes and farm shops and so on, they've become more. Not exactly fashionable. I think fashionable is partly what they've become, but they're more visible in that sense. So people do like this connection between the original producer. But I think it's this whole sort of seasonality expectation.
Really. I have to say, if there's a silver lining in any of this, there's a part of me that is I like the idea of actually only having a strawberry for those couple of weeks in the summer. I don't want a strawberry in January, and returning to that sort of, let's be more in tune with what the season's about,
And people used to do a lot of preservation.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, there's been a comeback to things like fermented foods, jam making, pickle making, people in their sort of 20s and 30s now are actually really quite enjoying doing this sort of thing and finding it's healthy.
The Kilner jar lives, doesn't it?
It does indeed.
Oh, they do, yeah.
They're quite a thing as well, aren't they?
They are.
Plums and so on.
Quite a thing.
Yeah. You've got to know what you're doing, though, because there's a few food safety issues there. But
There's a feature for a future week, isn't there, I think? How to bottle your plums.
Yes, you've got to. I mean, sorry, I was suddenly turning into Fanny Craddock because that was my persona.
You came over all Fanny on us.
I came over all Fanny. Bottle your plums, darling.
We might have to get Fanny to tell us about that in a few months' time. Sue, thank you very much for coming in. Lovely to see you as always. And you're back tomorrow lunchtime with Flavour, I think.
I am indeed. Yes.
And with Matt.
What have you got coming up on Flavour?
Oh, we've got some exciting things. There is something from Polly Russell, British Library, about the earliest recipe. There is Rosie Sykes, I believe, with... now, what is she talking about? I think she's involved with Eat Cambridge.
So the opening dinner for that, isn't it?
Indeed,
well?
That's right. I did an interview with the Union Bar 1815 about their new cocktails, and there's this amazing cocktail that actually looks like the River Cam, which is bizarre.
Wow.
It's brown underneath, blue on top, and it tastes incredible.
Really?
Yes. Sounds good. Top look forward to listening to that Flavour tomorrow at 1 and on the radio player after that. Cambridge 105 Radio.